Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Thursday, August 29th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our brand new website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
McMurray Hatchery is the world's oldest and largest rare breed hatchery. They have been providing their customers quality poultry since 1917 and have more than 110 different breeds to choose from. Be sure to sign up for their weekly special email at McMurrayHatchery.com and receive a $5 internet exclusive coupon to use on your first internet order. McMurray Hatchery, the world's largest and oldest rare breed hatchery.
You need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea. Technology you can trust.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. This is a special Thursday episode of Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown. How cool is that? We had a great time on Monday. We took tons and tons of questions from our Facebook fans, Twitter followers, and I think we even had a question from a caller. How awesome was that? And a lot of different information was covered. So when we had an opening today, hey, Peter Brown stepped up and said, hey, let's do it again. We had such a great time on Monday. So, again, another great episode of Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown. We've got a lot of questions posted on our Facebook and Twitter account, and I will be taking phone calls as well. If you'd like to call in live and talk to Peter Brown, the Chicken Doctor, if you have a question about your backyard chicken flock, how awesome is that? So we are here at the beginning, really, of a lot of people's weekend. It is a long weekend. It is a holiday weekend. It is Labor Day weekend. It is finally here. And the RVs are, believe me, are alive and well, especially tomorrow. I think there's about 40 units coming into this particular park just tomorrow. I bet we probably have another 20 coming in today or so. So the sound of diesel pushers and Class Cs and travel trailers and fifth wheels and everything else in the background you might hear getting all set up, and that's going to be a humdinger of a weekend. So I had a great time last night at karaoke. Let's see what we sung. Practicing up for a big show Saturday night. But so we did the Elvis American Trilogy again, God Bless the USA, I'll Fly Away. And I think there was one more that we did, and I can't remember what it was. But we had a good time last night at karaoke. How about that? Jen had water aerobics this morning, and she is back now watching the two types, so no problems. And we're having a great time here as we are on the road. This is a little three-month trip for us, and so looking forward to that. And we're looking for a place to kind of travel down into Florida for the winter. You know, head to Florida for the winter like all the snowbirds, but we're searching, actively searching for a place that'll be just right for our family. And Jenna started, or will start September 1st with her homeschool curriculums here, which is very, very soon. And we'll start doing that with Caleb, and she's already got geared up, so how cool is that? Gotta love it. Christmas Chick in the chat room says she'll be ordering her quail tomorrow. That's very, very exciting. You're going to have to keep us posted next week. Now, remember, no show Monday. It is Labor Day. We want you to spend a nice, long, wonderful, and fun weekend with your family and friends. I hope you have a blessed weekend. Hope you have time to relax before you head back to work on Tuesday, and we'll be back on Tuesday as well. So enjoy your long weekend. We hope you will do just that. Sending a real quick shout out to all the homeschoolers out there, speaking of homeschooling, that listen to this radio show live and incorporate it into their curriculum. Thank you very much for doing so. All the over-the-road truck drivers we hear from on a regular basis, thank you for tuning in to our archive show 24/7, keeping you awake in the wee hours, keep the rubber on the road. All of the live listeners that listen live, the thousands of archive listeners that listen to us on iTunes.com, podcast.com, Zoom.com, and of course right here at blogtalkradio.com. And also, last but not least, I want to send a shout-out to all the feed and seeds across the country that stream this radio show live for their customers every single day. Thank you very much for doing so. We do appreciate it. Hope business as well. Well, it looks like a happy birthday is in order. Christmas Chick in the chat room. Her birthday is tomorrow. She looks like she's going to be a cool and young 39 years of age. So, got to love it. Congratulations, Christmas Chick, turning 39 again. All righty, got to love it. Happy birthday, Christmas Chicken. And hey, you know what? I don't have chickens clucking the birthday song. That's probably something I need to look for. But how about we do a little short one this? Since you are Christmas Chick, you're located in Christmas, Florida, and you're called Fort Christmas Farm. How about this for your birthday? There you go. We wish you a happy birthday. We wish you a happy birthday. We wish you a happy birthday. And another one soon. How about that? In fact, folks, this is very recent. It has been a proven study that the more birthdays you have, the longer you live. That's a proven fact. That is a study that was done. The more birthdays you have, the longer you live. I guarantee it. That was an official study done by Yale. So I just want to make sure that we're all about facts here on the show and scientific information. So I thought I'd start off and share that with you. So, all right, let's go to the phone line. It's going to be a little bit shorter show today, but we should be able to get through all of our questions before 1 p.m., maybe real 1 to 1:15, but max 1:15. And so let's give a big Chicken Whisperer welcome to Peter Brown, the Chicken Doctor. All righty, Peter. Hey, thanks for coming on today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, glad to be here.
Let's go ahead and get started, and we'll roll over here to the old... Actually, let me go to Twitter first. Had a Twitter post, and some of these are repeat. Our longtime listeners, regular listeners, hear these on occasion, but some people can't listen. They're at work, they're in the fields, they're in the farm, they're in the classrooms teaching, whatever, so occasionally we'll have some repeats, but we've got one from Frank Head here over on our Twitter account. He says, what is causing my chicken to have a bald butt? His chicken has a bald butt, and he sent over a picture, and it looks like he is the hen does have a bald butt, and as always, it's right around the vent, and it looks like it's probably about an inch to 2 inches out from around the vent, and that's the only spot, and it is completely bald. What say you, Peter Brown?
Well, it's a tough one because... you know, if they have a rooster, it could be that. If they don't, it could be anything from bacterial to fungal. Or nutritional. And why it happens in that particular spot, I couldn't say for sure. Those kinds of things have a tendency sometimes to be genetic as well. But I would look at it maybe even being a fungal problem. Fungal problems are harder to see because it's really down at the base of the feather follicle where the feather enters the skin, and you really can't necessarily see it. Picking is another one. So it's tough to answer that particular question with a very definitive answer, but those are some of the things I would look. I'd make sure I sit down with the 5-gallon bucket out in the yard and see if there's anybody picking on this particular bird. Probably not, but, you know, it's worth taking a look at. Because many times I've seen birds just stand there, and this happens lots of times with a hen will stand there and pick the hackle feathers off of a rooster and just pull them right out, and she ends up eating them, and he'll just stand right there and let her do it. And then I've seen other ones where he'll beat her up if she tries that stuff. So it all depends. It is possible to be a nutritional factor. I've seen this on occasion as a nutritional factor in birds that were very productive. Doesn't mean that the person isn't feeding them properly. It just means that with the high production rate of eggs, that when they lose feathers in this particular area, that they can't put them back on because of the nutrition being diverted to the egg-laying process. So there are a number of things that go into this. Bacterial infection on the skin, that's a possibility. The fungal infection is probably something I'd lean a little bit more to. Feather picking, probably not so much. Mating, a little bit maybe. These are all things, like I said, genetics maybe. Very hard to put your finger on because there is no great...
Mites?
Yeah.
Okay.
There is no great degree of scientific evidence to point one way or another, no particular test that a person could run. Barring any other disease problems, we see this sometimes when birds get, real loose droppings, and the droppings start to get sticky and they stick around the vent. You will see some feather loss at that particular time as well. The other thing that this could very well possibly be, and this lends itself to a genetic situation, again, you can't prove it, but birds go into a partial molt, and it could be anywhere. Technically, if you look at things by the book, birds molt their feathers in particular order, usually starting with the wing feathers and then working towards the body feathers. We see this a lot, especially in commercial birds, where we'll see birds go into a neck molt where they lose all the feathers from just under the lower mandible or beak all the way down to the beginning in the front of the chest where the crop is. Some do it, some don't. And a lot of people will attribute it to cage birds, you know, rubbing in and on the kitten. It's really caused more than likely by stress. And it's what they call a partial molt. And we've been seeing a lot of this in birds lately, molting at all different times of the year, all kinds of things. And it's brought on, you know, all that's hormonally and genetically controlled for the most part. So I guess that's the best answer I can offer at this particular moment.
No worries. That sounds great. All the answers are very appreciative, so thank you so much for that. We'll go over back over to our Facebook page. Here's an interesting one. Jessica asks, what causes impaction of food within a bird's soft palate? A friend has a reoccurring problem with food impaction in the mouth and subsequent infections.
I'm going to assume that they're talking about in the roof of the mouth and the nasal cleft. I would be careful to look at that, and it may not be food. There may be food stuck in there, but there would. It's a great place for canker to set up shop. It's one of the places that we usually do find it in that nasal cleft in the roof of the mouth. If they're talking about in the bottom of the mouth, I can't, definitively say what would particularly cause it. And again, canker can appear anywhere in the bird's mouth, on the tongue, over the glottis, which is where they breathe, down the back of the throat, roof of the mouth, along the edges of the beak, on the tongue, corners of the mouth, may even work its way through the infraorbital space between the eye and the cheekbone, and work its way up and come out in the eye cavity. We've seen it so many numerous ways that it can come out. So she's talking about in the roof of the mouth, and it's also related to what they eat. The finer the food, the more the opportunity to do that. It may be a defect in that nasal cleft being a little bit larger than some other birds. But I would look at it as being potentially a disease problem. I would look at what's in there. If it's easily cleaned out, it's more than likely food. If it's actually stuck to the tissue of the roof of the mouth, it's more than likely a problem with canker, and then you would use canker tablets to take care of that.
Okay, great one. We've got a couple I saw on two different spots where I posted, so this will answer two questions we've had today. And we answered this, I think, even yesterday. You had talked about this, but we'll do it again today. It says, my chickens have never showed any signs of worms. Do I still need to worm them? If so, what do I use? And I know you talk about worming, using two different warmers, and then kind of alternating those and whatnot, but I'll let you share with this is
well,
for Becky.
First off, no signs.
Do I still need to worm them? I think the other question somewhere down the line that I saw earlier was that do I need to worm my chickens if I don't see any worms, or do I need to worm them for prevention, say, twice a year like some people do? So, well, this is a two-part question because I did see the other one on another forum that for today.
Okay. Well, let's start with basically the last statement. I don't believe in worming as a preventative. I don't think you can prevent worms by worming, and I don't believe in worming for the sake of worming. I have always been a proponent of becoming a poop inspector, walking around the yard, looking at droppings, getting a little stick, moving them around, looking for the signs of worms. Where the birds roost at night is a great place. When you turn them out in the morning, look under the roost. You can tell an awful lot by a bird's droppings, the looseness of the dropping, the color of the dropping. You can look to see if there's any worms. Round worms would appear as a opaquish white round worm that is like spaghetti. Your tapeworms are more flat and serrated, and the smaller ones can look like grains of rice and that kind of thing. So you can look for some blood in the droppings, coccidia. So droppings tell you an awful, awful lot about birds. Mm-hmm. And while we're on the subject of droppings, I just want to say that going back to my favorite subject of coccidiosis, all of the research over the years, and I want to throw this out there because there was a couple of problems that I've dealt with here and not too long ago in conjunction with this. If you, as soon as you see blood in the droppings, you need to treat for coccidiosis immediately. And I don't care what this guy, that guy says. I don't care what you read somewhere. I'm telling you what the research says. I'm telling you that once the bleeding starts, it is extremely hard to stop with whatever medication you use. Because if you were able to see what the intestine looked like at that point in time, you would get a greater understanding of just what's going on. It's devastating to the intestine. It's just, can imagine just taking your hand and taking a piece of real coarse sandpaper and just sanding the top of your hand till it bled readily all by itself. That's what's happening to that intestine. It's being destroyed. And getting enough medication into a bird quickly to solve that particular problem is tough. And then stopping it and having the intestine repair itself and all of that stuff. And that's why we see a lot of mortality from coccidiosis. I know it had nothing to do technically with this question, but while we're on the subject, I did mention looking in the droppings for signs of blood. You treat everybody. You don't look to see who it is. You know that there's a blood problem. I've been through it before with people. Well, it's just a piece of the intestine sloughing off and this and that and the other thing. You're much better off to treat it, and even if it's a false alarm, you're just much better off to do it right then and there, because once it gets a toehold 2, 3, 4 days down the road, they're going to start being your mortality. So I'm not a proponent of worming, but if I was going to worm on a precautionary basis, I would probably start with diatomaceous earth. You run into no problems as far as, you know, eating the carcass, eating the eggs, or any detriment basically to the bird whatsoever. It is not going to do a whole lot for tapeworms as far as removing the scolex, which is the mouth part that embeds in the intestine. But by the same token, if you were doing the due diligence, this is like maintenance on a car. Okay, this is like not waiting till the tire blows out to replace the tire. You know, changing the oil on the engine and those kind of, changing your windshield wiper blades and so on. They're all part of the deal. So if you are watching the droppings and everything else, you're probably not going to want to worm in the first place. But if you had an inkling of an idea that you wanted to, roundworms being the most common, I would start with the diatomaceous earth and work from there. The next step up, you know, if that doesn't cut it for you, then I would go with the piperazine. Read the label, okay? It's not to be used in birds for producing eggs for human consumption, period. Not that I used it and how long should I wait. That's all up to the individual. That has nothing, there's nothing on the label going to tell you that. You know, personally myself, I really don't think using piperazine, it's been around for a zillion years, relatively safe for the most part. I don't think that you know, you're going to have a big deal eating the eggs one way or another. But, you know, legally and, you know, can't tell people just go ahead and do it willy-nilly. It just can't. But, you know, and then after that, if you've really got some worm problems, then, you know, the valbazin is your next step. And you could worm them with that. But that's the approach that I take to worming. Become a poop inspector first and see what's going on in your flock and so on. And you'll be much better off for it. You'll spend a heck of a lot less money by doing some of this maintenance. I know that sounds dumb from a guy kind of that sells the stuff, but you know, for me, it's not always about selling the stuff. It's about the bird. It's about how we can fix these situations, how we can keep them from recurring constantly. And this is all part of the game. This is how you do it. You just get that bucket out and sit out there in that yard and enjoy them, because that's what they're there for.
Perfect. All righty, great answer, and hopefully that'll help both of our questions today. Okay, we've got one here from Lisa. Why, after 2 years, have my flock started to attack and alienate one of my hens? After 2 years, they have found a low hen on the totem pole, on the pecking order, if you will, apparently, and they just, after 2 years of happy-go-lucky, they've started alienating one and attacking her.
Interesting. Some sort of dynamic in that group of birds has changed. Whether it's the shyness or of this particular hen that maybe, unbeknownst to the owner, She's become a little bit more shy. And they sense these things. They sense these changes in a flock situation. For some reason, something has triggered it. Something changed in the environment. If you remember when we talked about behavioral problems earlier this year, we talked about wearing the same thing when you go into a coop so that it doesn't upset the rooster and he doesn't look at you and decide that you're alien and not the person, you know, that's been keeping him for the last 2 years and feeding him and watering him and caring for them, changing perfume or wearing perfume when you didn't before. They notice these things, believe it or not, and that may change their total behavior either for that day, or it may trigger something that every time they see you, they will attack you. Give you, for instance, just here in our own coop, you know, we've got roughly, like I said not too long ago, about 30 chickens or so. Amongst the chickens, basically two different breeds. The predominant breed is a Nankin, predominantly very docile for the most part, and a couple of, I think there's four or five Deanvers in that group. And, you know, they're all Bantams, and I see we've got two ducks, two khaki Campbell ducks. And the roosters just want to take the duck on. The duck's about four times the size of the chicken, and it doesn't matter. I like to watch them. I don't let them, you know, hurt each other, but I like to watch them and try to see things from their perspective. And I just think that they're not able to recognize them as being a different species, so to speak, but they recognize them as being a threat. And therefore, as keeper of the flock, with a particular group of birds, you're going to take him on no matter how big he is. It's kind of like the bully on the block, you know. You can't beat him, you get a stick and whack him over the head. You got to do something. So it's kind of like the same thing. And so the dynamics of that flock changed in some fashion. If the bird was at the bottom of the pile, maybe for some reason, you know, they feel she's further down the pile, or maybe they feel she's inferior in some way that they and only they can detect. New surroundings, changing waters, changing feeders, putting in new roost, nest boxes, new coops, moving birds around, all of those things, all dynamics that change. And we see this a lot. We see birds never go back to where they were. They just don't. And I don't know whether a particular group of birds just feel like they're more powerful now all of a sudden. But that's the best answer I can give at this
okay,
point.
That's great.
Without having, you know, more information, talking to the owner and that kind of thing. Yeah. But something changed within that hierarchy there. And, I obviously can't say. It could have been a change in the feed. Who knows? She didn't necessarily say it was roosters doing this. It was other hens, I'm assuming. And you know, God only knows why a rooster will change his behavior. You know, more testosterone one day than the next. I don't know. You know.
Gotcha. Oh, great answer. Great answer. I'm going to take this next one. And Becky asks here on our Facebook page, my eggs are clean when I collect them. Do I just wash them with warm water before using? And so let me back up here, and I'll get to your question here in a second. Number one, you put your eggs are clean, and that is great. That means you have clean nesting boxes. The chickens are not staying in the nesting boxes a long time and having a siesta, which is great. So they're not sitting in there, sleeping in there, spending time in there, pooping in there, which then gets poop all over your eggs. So I commend you for having clean eggs out of the nesting box. That is great, and congratulations to you. So based on that, folks, again, most every expert I've talked to, a nesting box is not a place for the hens to go to spread gossip, to get their hair done, to get their nails done, to sit there and relax and read 50 Shades of Grey. They are to get in and get the hell out and do their business. It is not a place for them to hang out and sleep in, especially at night or during the day, and take naps or anything like that. They get in and they get out. That's why I just love the rollaway nest boxes. That solves a lot of problems. Plus, it's a little on level, so it's not too comfortable for them. I love the nesting box pads versus any type of little shavings or hay or wheat straw that they can make a little nest and get all nice and comfortable. They're scratchy. They're uncomfortable on their tushy, so they get in. Hopefully they lay their egg and they get the heck out. You do not want your hens spending a lot of time in the nesting boxes. That includes sleeping. That includes spreading gossip, getting their nails done, reading books, whatever the case may be. So if you have nesting box curtains to make your coop look good, that's great. No worries. But the whole goal here, every expert we've ever had on the show, whether it be commercial, backyard, scientist, whatever, in and out. It is not a place for them to hang out for long periods of time. So, Becky, I commend you for having a clean egg out of the nesting box. That tells me that yours aren't hanging out in there and taking a siesta. So that would be a big no-no. So number two, regarding washing them, everybody on the planet has their own opinion about this. I will first start off by saying, because I worked with them on occasion, the USDA and the FDA, the CDC, all of the big boys, the big Gs, the alphabet groups, whatever you want to call them, they, of course, are always going to take heed on the side of caution and be like, hey, wash your eggs. No matter what, don't care how clean they are, whatever the case may be, wash your eggs as soon as you collect them and immediately put them in the fridge. Okay, they're going to do that. You know, that's their throw. Okay, let me tell you my theory on this. Okay, I don't think I've been on this planet 43 years, Becky, and I don't think I have cracked an egg one time in my life. Whether I'm doing scrambled eggs, baking a pie, baking a cake, doing cookies, it doesn't matter. If eggs were involved and cracking those eggs were involved, honestly, in 43 years, I don't think I've ever had an eggshell not fall into the pot. And so even though you're thinking, hey, you know what, I'm going to cook my eggs really good, and you know, and every event I go to and I talk about this, someone in the back, an old-timer, God bless their soul, is like, well, I've never washed a single egg in my life, and I'm 85, and I'm standing here, and I'm as healthy as a horse. Great. Keep doing what you're doing, just like Peter always says. But I have, yes, the bloom protects a lot of times the inside of the egg from a lot of the contaminants. We understand that. But everything comes out of the same hole. The poop, the urites, drainage, everything. It's on the outside of that egg. So I drop the egg in the egg, in the cake, in the batter, in this, in that, making muffin, whatever. So now whatever nastiness is on the outside of the egg has now just entered into my food source, whether it be muffin mix, cake mix, scrambled eggs, whatever the case may be. And yes, I can cook it at 160 degrees for so long and get rid of it. But our theory is this. We will gather our eggs. We have a basket that sits next to the sink. We go out and gather our eggs. Once that basket is full, whether it takes one day, 2 days, or 3 days, once it's full, then we use the lukewarm water. We have a dollar store scrubby that we bought for a buck. We clean the egg, we let it dry on a paper towel, we put it in an egg carton, and we put it in the fridge. Now, some people, in fact, I hear from a lot of people, that gather the eggs, put them in a carton, and put them in the fridge. And then they actually wait to wash them until right before they use them. They feel that keeping the bloom on the egg actually will keep it fresher for longer, okay? Well, my question to those folks is, how long are you keeping your eggs? You know, I mean, keeping the bloom on for the 3 or 4 days before I eat the sucker, I can't see making much difference. They're hella beans. So, I mean, if you're keeping your eggs for a year before you eat them, then, maybe you want to keep the bloom on. Maybe that makes a difference to you. But if I'm collecting eggs today and I'm eating them tomorrow, the next day, or even the next couple of weeks, I don't see a need to keep the bloom on if that's your theory that it's going to keep the egg fresher. Keeping it on. If you're keeping them for a year or two before you eat them, you know, that's your business. And that may make some, you know, help out a little bit, but I don't know how many people who keep their eggs for 6 months before they eat them. So that's, we go through this all the time when we're out on the road. All the big G-men, the alphabet group, wash them immediately, refrigerate them immediately. Others, you know, collect them, just let them sit on the counter for, you know, until you get the basket full, wash them lukewarm water, the dollar store brush, dry them, put them in the carton. And then some people don't wash them until, they still wash them, but they don't wash them until right before they use them. They keep the bloom on as long as they possibly can. So that, Becky, is what I hear most when I'm around the country. And you still have some that say, I've never washed an egg in all my 84 years. I'm still here. I'm strong as a horse. Keep doing what you're doing. That's great. But you, honestly, I could say, well, tell that to the dead lady that got salmonella, and now she's dead in her grave because she's never washed an egg in her life. I don't know the numbers. I don't know how many people that's happened to. But there's probably somebody out there that said, I don't need to wash my eggs, and they're dead. So that's your call. Keep doing what you're doing, but that's what we share with everybody when we're on the road, when they're washing the eggs. Topic comes up, but I commend you for having clean eggs. It means that you're probably more than likely your chickens are hanging out in the nesting boxes. Anything to add to that, Peter Brown?
Well, not really. I go back, and you've heard me say this many, many times on the show. You can do a lot of things that have some potential harm to you and never have it happen to you. Okay. I usually use the one about running out in front of the bus every morning on your way to work. You cross the road, here comes the bus. It's been happening for months, maybe years, and you dash out in front of the bus today and you didn't see the little stone or the little piece of concrete that's lifted up. You stubbed your toe, fell over, and the bus runs you over. So, it's usually when you least expect it. It's not usually something that you plan for and that kind of thing. And I always like to err on the side of caution. I think it's a good idea to do a little bit of washing. And I am a bigger fan of refrigerating the eggs as soon as possible if you're using them for eating purposes and so on. And, this is a little bit out of what we're kind of talking about on the outside of the egg, but, there are those people who believe, and there is some validity to it, the albumin of the egg does have some antibiotic properties, but, and I know we're talking about the outside of the egg, but when we do our update on salmonella and stuff, there's a whole body of evidence to prove that the salmonella has a workaround for that albumin, and that's why it's able to hang out in the egg and infect people. So, if you like raw eggs, eat them raw. If you get sick, be able to deal with the consequences of it. I guess that's the way I look at it. And I think your analogy of, cracking an egg over whatever you're making, and not having some sort of a piece of a shell. I mean, I don't know how many times I've made over the years when I was eating eggs. I don't eat them now, but when I was eating eggs, it's making scrambled eggs or whatever, and had to pick the damn shell out. I mean,
or even if the shell doesn't fall in, how many times does the white, the albumin, run down the side of the eggshell and drop into the
bacteria
on the outside of the shell?
I think that looking at it logically, I mean, it makes just good sense to wash it. And like you said, there will be, one person that says that they wash them and the other person hasn't done it in 50 years, and my hat's off to you. You've been extremely lucky over that period of time. That's all it means. And, as to whether you wash them first and put them in the refrigerator or you leave the bloom on them and you, wash them later, I don't think it matters a whole lot. 6 1 half dozen the other. I think it's more important to wash them. You don't have to give them a bath like you give your dog or cat.
Right.
Just a quick rinse off deal like you were talking about. I think is fine. It always amazed me that people will take eggs that are like mud balls and try to clean them up and either hatch them or eat them. I don't know. I'm not up for that. I don't know about anybody else, but those are usually. At least in the hatching world, they were always a thing of disaster. When I was in that particular part of the industry, I made sure that those made their way to the trash pile real quick. So.
Exactly. Okay, good one. We have another one from Becky, and she writes, my chickens free range during the day. Is there anything to do to deter and keep chicken hawks away? And I say this when we're doing our shows across the country, and I smile and I joke a little bit about it. It's probably a little overkill to the extreme, but the point is well taken. If you want to free range 100 chickens, then go ahead and buy 200, because eventually you'll have 100. I know that's extreme, but it gets the point across, though. Hey, get 200, because eventually if you want 100, you'll have it. Due to all kinds, not just the chicken hawks, but all the other ground predators and things like that, even if they go back to. Now, regarding her specifics, keeping the hawks away, if you're not using any type of netting or any type of tractors out there, Joe Salatin does, pasture-raised chickens like that, they are just strictly free-range, roaming all over your property. There's probably not a whole lot you can do. I know that some companies sell this very, very, very reflective tape, almost like as the, what's it called, the hieroglyphics tape and printing on it, and like the credit cards used to have on them to make sure they were valid. But and so you can buy rolls of this tape, but I just don't know. I mean, I don't know what area we're talking about. And if you're going to stick this stuff and hang this from all the trees in your five-acre property, your neighbors probably won't be happy. Your visitors will come and say, what in the heck is going on here? And then even then, there's still no guarantee that they won't get used to that and won't be afraid of that and would still come down and get a free meal. So if I think that just goes hand in hand, you know, you drive a convertible, your hair is going to get a little messed up. You're going to free range. You know, you need to factor in losing a few to predators, even though that's the way you want to raise your chickens. Peter, any ideas for Becky?
No, I think that, you know, if you're not able to put, you know, the area that they're free ranging under cover, and most people can't or wouldn't, I think that reflective tape is good. I've known some people that had some success with the old aluminum pie tins clanging around. You know, a little bit of noise always goes a long way, because most of your hawks are kind of wary of that stuff. But they're also pretty bold. I was reading one here not too long ago on the Internet where the party was standing right there within, you know, 8 or 10 feet of the birds, and the hawk just swooped down and tried to grab it right in front of them. And so, I mean, they are bold. And, you know, when they're hungry, you know, they're looking for a meal, and predation has always been a problem. I mean, even when you've got them cooped up at night, if you don't have things fixed so that predators can't get in, the chickens are going to be very vulnerable. So I would opt for some noisy things, things of that nature. I know here 2 years ago I had a problem with these turkey buzzards. I didn't want them roosting in a tree here, and you just had to be around every night, because once they got to roosting, you could forget it. You weren't getting them out of there. And it actually cost me a lot of money, because the only thing that they really responded to was these air horns that you could get, you know, you can buy them at Walmart and whatever, but I was buying them by the half dozen, you know, to like a foghorn type thing, but it had to be real loud. Anything real, real low just... you know, just didn't make a move. Clanging pots and pans, they just, you'd make them raise their wings up, but they wouldn't get out. And it took me quite a while, but I had to be around every night when they were going to roost. Otherwise, they would roost there and finally move them out. But it can be a chore. And, you know, once one of these predators, they're not really predators, they're more carrion eaters, but I still didn't want them, you know, pooping in the yard here because they make a mess. And it wasn't one of them, it was one that's not so bad, but there was like 50 of them. And I'm not up to that. And I've seen before where, you know, where people, you know, and they're protected. You really can't, you know, you can't shoot them, or would I, but, you can't even, you know, use, technically, what I was doing is technically not even legal. And, at any rate, once a predator sets up shop in your neighborhood, it's pretty tough to get rid of them. So when hawks, you know, when your birds are in a hawk's territory, other than covering them up, they're still going to be vulnerable no matter what you put up.
Right.
You know, as a deterrent, those are the things that I would do anyway.
Okay. Yeah, good deal. Good deal. Let's see. Moving right along here, where do we go? We get this question occasionally of all the different types of eggs that pop out of people's hens. Some of my eggs, this comes to us from, I believe it's... Hanley. Some of my eggs look as if they are wrinkled. Some other look as if they have two colors, one side darker brown and the other side lighter brown, and it's not smooth like my other eggs. Appreciate any information you can share. So, and we see that a lot. We see a lot of raised dots and spots on the eggs. We'll see waves in them. We'll see them wrinkled, all different shapes. We'll see shellless eggs. But in her case, a lot of them are wrinkled, or some look wrinkled, and some have two different color variations on them, and are not really smooth, but a little bumpy. What say you, Doc Brown?
Generally, the it's an over-deposition of calcium when you see the little spots on the eggs, as a general rule. Mostly a genetic problem, more than likely. The crinkling is generally related to, can be genetic, but lots of times it's related to a bird being spooked before the shell actually hardens in the shell gland. Don't forget, the egg itself will spend somewhere around 22 and a half, 23 hours or so in the shell gland itself, putting the calcium down for the eggshell. So a lot can happen, you know, during that period of time. A thunderstorm, kids chasing the birds, you know, all of these different anomalies can come along and cause that. There could be an imbalance of the calcium-phosphorus ratio. We've talked about that before. When that gets out of balance, it ties up the vitamin D3, and you start getting, you know, thinner eggs, shelled eggs. You get more porous eggs, more fragile eggs, and that kind of thing. A bout of bronchitis can certainly cause it. That usually causes a lot of the crinkling, a lot of the rough sandpapery type eggs, slab-sided eggs where it's flat on one side, round on the other, all of those. And also, you know, a deformed oviduct can do most of these things as well. So there's no one answer to it. If mm-hmm. it's a perpetual problem with the same hen, you know, then that you know, that could lead itself to being some sort of a genetic thing. You know, all things being equal, you know, you have to look at what's being fed, how many treats are being given, you know, which kind of throws things you know, out of whack as far as the as the dietary part of it is concerned. You know, was there ever any problem in the flock, you know, with coccidiosis, where we have impaired intestinal health, so that the intestines are, you know, while the bird looks healthy on the outside, they're not absorbing all the nutrients on the inside, leads to, you know, problems with eggshell and so on. The color part of it usually is related to, but not always, genetics. We, as the birds age, we have a tendency to see, you know, brown eggs have a tendency to get lighter, and that type of thing. So it's not uncommon. We see it a lot. The soft-shelled egg thing, you might see that in a. Usually, we see it in two categories of birds, but it can happen at any time. But we generally see it in older birds, or birds just coming into lay who, for whatever reason, have not. Their body hasn't figured out how to make the shell complete at that point in time. But it usually by the second, third egg, that stuff goes away. Again, all things being equal, the nutrition being okay and the bird being healthy and the gut being okay and that kind of thing. I was reading some interesting information not too long ago. I'll just throw this out there for, you know, in giving treats, we talk about the intestinal microbiota or the flora of the gut. And we've done loads and loads and loads of talk about that. But all these different treats, giving different things during the course of the day, I have personally been noticing different folks that I deal with seem to have, after they do these things, whether it be giving a lot of tomatoes, a lot of melon, and all these other things, when you upset the flora of that gut by doing some of these things, you invite problems. It is no different than a human being more stable in their diet than everything else within that human being, going to the bathroom, the whole bit. Same thing for a chicken. It becomes more stable, more predictable. And so every time we upset that gut flora, don't forget, over 60% of the bird's immune system lies in the gut. So you have a bad gut, you've got a bird that's in trouble. Okay, see, almost two-thirds of the immune system would be under attack at any given time then by things that are going on in the gut. The interesting thing, I've been talking about this on the human side for a long time as well, you know, on and off, and it was just on the news again today, no big deal, I've heard it before, but, you know, they're making, there's a study that was done, I believe out of Denmark this time, and this was done on people who were obese, and what they found was that these people do not have the same microbiota in their gut as people who might be thinner, and that there is a relation, and by changing the gut flora, they were able to help these folks to some degree control their weight. So there is a connection there. Exactly how it all works and everything else will, you know, be worked out in the future, I'm sure. But very, very important not to upset that gut. And when you do, it leads to other things. You know, we talked about in our supplementation, we talked about the four-way stop. You know, when something's missing, nothing else moves. And the one that's stuck in the middle, whatever it is, that whether it be calcium, phosphorus, vitamin D3, B12, whatever, it's going to cause some sort of backup somewhere else, and there's going to be a problem with some other system, or whether it be the egg or the contents of the egg, or so on. So, that's the best answer I think I can give for that at this point in time.
Okay, no, that's great.
Super information.
Go ahead, get back over here. My computer's messing up. I got that virus that clicks in every now and then, and my letters don't type in a straight line.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
So, okay, just wanted to make sure. Let's see what we got here. We've got...
still not working. Hang on. There we go. I'll type the letter, and the cursor will go back to the beginning halfway through a sentence or halfway through a word, and it's not fun. So I've got a really good one here. Let me go to commercial break, and I'll go ahead and read you the question. You can be thinking about your answer because it is. It's I don't think we've had the question before. It's really good. This comes to us from Lil Becker. I had a hen that died suddenly. We did a necropsy, and she was diagnosed with fatty liver disease. I read all of the associated material, but they are really not clear on why layer feed, apples, pumpkins, sunflower seeds, mealworms, scratch, and free ranging caused this to happen. Can you please give some specifics on what to avoid or minimize in their diet so she is the last one we have with this problem. So a little bit of information about fatty liver disease, and I'll repeat that again when we come back. That'll give you a little heads up there, Peter, to think about your answer. And folks, we'll be back in just a few minutes. We're going to go to a short commercial break. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of First State Vet Supply, and we're taking your calls and your questions from our Facebook page and our Twitter page. So stay with us. There'll be more to come when we return.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer. If you're in the market for a new incubator, then look no further than GQF. They have a great selection of tabletop and cabinet-style incubators at prices you can afford. I love my GQF Genesis Model 1588. It has a large picture window and an automatic thermostat, which makes for a better hatch every time. Go pick out your new incubator at GQFradio.com. That's GQFradio.com. Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry. From rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams, Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com. Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
And you can find all the great Ware products here.
Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com. Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer, here to tell you that if you have backyard poultry, nothing is more important than making sure your feathered friends are safe from infectious poultry diseases. Learn the simple steps to keep your birds healthy by visiting this website, healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov. That's healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov.
A message from the USDA.
This looks like a job for
Super Chicken.
You get the super sauce. I'll don my super suit.
How would you like a punch in the beak?
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, a special Thursday edition of Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown. And let's see, as this thing stops spinning, there we go. We've got Peter back on live here on the show, and I'm going to go ahead and repeat the question. Very interesting. Had a hen that died suddenly. We did a necropsy, and she was diagnosed with fatty liver disease. I read all the associated material, but they're really not clear on why. Layer feed, apples, pumpkins, sunflower seeds, mealworms, scratch, and free-ranging caused this to happen to my chicken. Can you give some specifics on what to avoid so it doesn't happen to any other of our chickens?
Yeah. this cuts right to where I'm at, and you're going to love this.
Okay.
Quit feeding all the excess junk. That's all it is. It's a bird's diet that is filled with, technically, too much junk. You've heard me say this time in and time out. Feed a complete feed and leave it alone. They don't need all the other stuff, and neither do humans either need all the crap they eat, okay? So this is generally caused by feeding a diet that has too much energy in it versus one you would think by looking at the title of the disease, fatty liver, you would think that you would find this in a diet being, you know, too much fat. But what's happening is that basically the carbohydrates are being turned into fat, not only abdominal fat, but fat in the liver. When this happens and you get these over deposits of fat in the liver becomes spongy. And if you know anything about a liver, whether it be human or otherwise, when you touch it and play with it around, it's got a mesenchyma over the top of it. It's like a little film over the top. You break that, and the thing bleeds nonstop. They have the same problem when they deal with people in the operating room, and you go messing with a liver that's not healthy, even when it is healthy, but even more so with one that's not healthy, and they bleed. A person can die just from that, and they do. Same thing with chickens. So when you get this, what happens is that the blood vessels in the liver rupture very easily, and the fact that a bird is laying an egg makes them rupture even more easily than that. Okay, and so what you have then is that the bird starts to bleed to death, basically from ruptured blood vessels within the liver itself. This is generally being caused by feeding. Again, people who feed scratch that has corn in it, all the excess carbohydrates that people would be feeding to birds, whatever it is, would go into this. Now, does that mean that a particular hen genetically wouldn't be more predisposed to this? That's a possibility. We've seen before where you put out corn. And birds will go over there and they'll just gorge themselves on it. They'll eat it. You put the regular feed there. Now we don't want that stuff. That's garbage. We're going to eat the corn. And therein lies part of the problem. So controlling more so what the bird eats, a good, well-rounded, complete laying feed is all they need. And, like I said before, if you really feel compelled that you can't, keep yourself from doing it, and you're going to fall over and faint if you don't give them a treat. You know, pick something that is going to be more of a contribution to the bird's overall health than a detriment. And too much corn, we've had it before, Andy, about several months back. Somebody called in, birds were 18, 20 weeks old or whatever, or even older, and they weren't laying. And when we questioned everything, they were feeding just corn.
Mm-hmm.
Just corn. And that's a, they're prime candidates for this. And we see it more in the laying hens because it's the, doesn't mean it can't happen in the rooster, but it generally doesn't. And we see, it's part of the egg laying process that also helps the rupture these blood vessels. So by feeding a well-rounded feed, staying away from the treats, freeze-dried meal worms and all the other stuff, they just don't need it. And I'm not a big fan of doing that. And when you do these things by giving all these extra things, you start changing the gut flora and you start creating other problems as well. This is an unintended consequence of being too nice, in my opinion. This is what happens, when you give too much stuff. And I call it junk because it is junk. That's the way I see it. All of the syndromes that birds have had in years past, the vitamin deficiencies, and they are technically, and I only say technically because things happen for different reasons, a thing of the past when you are feeding a good quality, well-rounded, commercial, complete feed, and you're keeping your birds healthy, free of disease, free of worms, free of coccidiosis, free of intestinal problems, free of respiratory problems. Get out there on that five-gallon bucket. Watch them. Susie's dragging her tail coming across the yard. She just isn't having a bad day. She's sick. Get on it now, or she'll be tomorrow or the next day or the next day's mortality. And that's just generally the way it goes. So this can be very easily taken care of by staying away from those things that are going to add to this problem and make the bird put down fat. And see, when you get that big fat pad, it makes it harder for the bird to even lay the egg because now you're starting to put pressure on the oviduct, and that's going to put pressure on the liver. And this liver becomes very, very fragile, very, very fragile. And sometimes we see this in high-producing birds because the higher-producing birds are going to eat more of that type of feed that they shouldn't because they like it. And we all know about, liking food that isn't necessarily good for us, human or otherwise. So, there is corn in your complete feed, but there's a measured amount in it, okay? And by you giving more corn or things of that nature or scratch grains that contain corn or other carbohydrate things that are high in energy that are just not going to contribute to the good overall health of the birds. So you're going to end up with this type of condition, very easily, for the most part, avoidable by just not doing the things that we've talked about so many times on this show that contribute to this kind of situation. Stay away from the corn. Stay away from the treats. That's what I would do.
All right. Sounds good. We're already at 106. Let me try to figure. I had another section of posts, so let me see if I can get here. If we had any repeats, or if we have some that I can really, really get to. We've already answered that one with the worming. Let's see.
And while you're looking there, I might add that this is this. And while you're looking for another question, I might just add that you might see this type of mortality, early morning or an overnight mortality as that egg is making its way down and getting ready to be laid. So there might be your early morning mortality. You might come out and find a bird dead who may have just laid an egg or been in the process of laying an egg and may be still hot to the touch and you can't figure it out. It's a very good possibility that this is what it could be, a sudden mortality, because it would be sudden. This would be a bird that you would look the picture of health to you because technically they are, okay? But on the inside, they're not.
That's perfect. Let's see here. Here we got one. This is interesting, and it probably affects a lot of people. This comes to us from Jim. I had a chick fall victim to a fire ant mound in the yard. He says the mound has been dealt with extreme prejudice. He said she passed this morning. The chicken died this morning. If I have another chick afflicted by fire ants. Is there anything I can do to help them increase the chance of survival?
I don't know anything that I could add to that. I really don't. I have no experience with it whatsoever.
So chickens and fire ants. Okay.
I think the only way to remedy that is find the source of the fire ants and get rid of them. And that could be a chore, from what I understand.
Right. It is. Here's one from you. Dwayne asks, are chickens susceptible to bot flies? If so, how do you treat them?
A bot fly is a fly that gets into and lays its eggs in your tissue. I think this is basically what he's talking about is something similar to fly strike. The thing to do is to try to eliminate it get rid of the flies to start with, and then they generally just don't, to my knowledge anyway, and this is something, again, you're not going to find a lot written about it, it's experience, but, I've had people, where they seem to settle down is on the back end of the bird, because if you've got a bird that's got a back end that's getting nasty, then that back end draws them to it. And that tissue is soft, it's moist, and it's a great place for them to deposit their eggs, and that's where you start with your fly strike. So if you can clean up those kinds of situations, get the fly population down, it's about all you can do. If it is becoming an issue, you might even try putting some garlic oil on the birds. A lot of flies and other things don't like it, but then again, some of them might, so it might be more of an attractant than a deterrent. But that's the way I would probably handle that one. But it can be a problem, and fly strike is certainly, if you don't catch it early, the maggots just eat into the body cavity, and then you're pretty much done with it. And we've had several cases of that this year. Not here at our farm.
Right.
Not here.
Got it. Let's see. We already talked a little bit about egg color. Let's see. Okay, here's a good one. Our five hens have lost all the feathers on their backs. Now, you and I both have seen that's relative based on with their definition of all the feathers. I mean, are they as bald as a chicken you buy in the store? Are they down to the pin feathers? Is there some? It just look bad. But she types, our five hens have lost all the feathers on their backs. We suspected the very mean rooster was doing it and found a new home for him, maybe the stew pot. And now that the hens are less stressed, will their feathers grow back, or will I need to knit them some nice little capes before cold weather comes in?
Yeah, they should grow back. They usually do. It's not a permanent thing. What generally happens with this is a couple of things. Once the birds are being treaded so hard by the rooster, and he's pulling out the feathers with his feet, the stress may keep the feathers from growing back in. And even so, when pin feathers start to come back in with him really hurting the girls pretty hard, end up, you know, destroying those, and it starts the process all over again. So, I would think I've never seen it not happen. Sometimes it's slower coming back. And you can add some nutritional things to their, the Vitapro B, along with the Replimin liquid, along with some of the A-lite amino acid has worked very, very well in doing some of these things, and all of those are included in the emergency medical kit, too. So, it would be a good idea for people to try to keep some of those things on hand for just situations like this. But, no, they should come back. They might come back slower than expected, but they will come back.
Perfect. I think I found one more we're going to wrap up with here. I think it was over here on this other column. Ah, here it is, from Linda. She says, my rooster has a nice red comb that sometimes turns purplish. Not completely, just a small part of the comb turns purple, and then it actually fades back to red. Is this something to worry about?
Could be. It could be. It depends on when it happens. Does it happen after he eats? Does it happen constantly? We talked about earlier in the year about the rooster's comb being a basically a sexual organ. It should be bright and red for most of the time. If it's turning, real dark when it was really bright red before, that indicates for some reason that there isn't enough blood flow going to it. When we talked about the blood flow before, we talked about the arteries that are in there. We talked about the vascularization, the veins, the microveins, and so on and so forth that are in the comb. So it's a highly vascularized, highly just loaded with blood, really. That's why when you just nick a part of the comb just ever so slightly, it starts to bleed. There's blood everywhere in that thing. So I would be wanting to know a little bit more about this to give a better answer, because is this a bird that has some possibilities of ascites? Does he have a problem with some water in the body cavity that makes him breathe funny sometimes? Is it a problem with his ability to close the glottis when he eats or drinks, and then that causes him to not get, to get some junk down into the trachea and cause, some cyanosis, which that's called when it turns dark like that in the comb due to lack of oxygen. So there's a number of different things that come to it. It generally is not considered to be normal, not from my I would, there's an issue. I don't know what. Has he got, other problems, other respiratory issues that are not being addressed that somebody is not aware of, or things of that nature? I'd listen in the coop at night when everybody's gone to roost. Just walk in, close the door, stand there for 10, 15 minutes, see if you can hear anything. It's snicking, snorting, squeaking, and those kinds of things. You kind of have to, these things that are not necessarily normal that occur, it's kind of like taking your car to the dealership, and say, it's making a squeak. When? Well, when I drive it. Well, that tells you a lot, Yeah. And so they drive your car and it doesn't squeak. You get the car back from the dealership, you go down the road 2 miles, start squeaking again. You bring it back and, you go through that routine. So it can be difficult to find out exactly what's going on. So you have to kind of be like Inspector Clouseau here, not as clumsy, but you have to be right on it and try to figure it out through a process of elimination. But it indicates to me that somewhere along the line there is a problem with oxygen flow, and just where it lies, I don't know.
Okay. No, very good answer and question. Well, we've kept you about 15 minutes longer than I said I would, but we wanted to get some of these were pretty darn good today, as they always are.
Yep.
And a special Thursday episode of Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown. We do this on occasion, and it's a big hit. We did it Monday, and people enjoyed it, so we said we'll do it again here on Thursday. So I know that this coming Monday show is not going to be around. It is Labor Day. We want all of our listeners to spend good quality time with their family and friends and enjoy their long weekend. So there will be no Ask the Chicken Doctor this Monday. I know that the following Monday, the 9th, is questionable because you may be on the road coming back from a big poultry event, and you'll definitely need that day of rest. I know and feel your pain being on the road, but we might look at just coming back on that Tuesday. But we'll let everybody, all our listeners, know when the next time you'll be on. But routinely, it's every single Monday right here on Blog Talk Radio. We've got Peter Brown, the Chicken Doctor with First State Vet Supply. Visit him online, folks. FirstStateVetSupply.com. That's FirstStateVetSupply.com. Every single thing he's going to sell you, every single thing that you're going to buy, well, first off, in our opinion, he doesn't have it, you don't need it. But it's going to come with specific directions for your chickens. So, you get it just about anywhere else here, you get it, and it says, what's my dose for 6 chickens? I don't have 6,000. I don't have 600. What's the dose? And then you end up calling Peter anyway to find out. So every single thing he's going to sell you has that dose for your backyard chickens. And so that alone is worth its weight in gold. So there's no reason to go anywhere else. FirstStateVetSupply.com. And he did make mention just a few minutes ago of his chicken health medicine kit. And so how many times do I or do Peter, when he's talking to somebody, trying to help them out and diagnose and treat their sick birds, does he say, okay, let's get started, I will recommend this, or, hey, what do you have on hand that we can start using? And 9 times out of 10, the answer is nothing. So now we've got to order, we've got to get shipping time, we've got to get the stuff to them, and by that time, the birds could be more detrimental to the birds waiting. So having this kit on hand, he's doing this so you don't have to buy an entire huge bottle of this stuff. All of this is smaller dose, smaller bottles for you to have on hand so you have something to give without having to hold on to a very expensive full bottle that may eventually go bad if you don't need it. So it's perfect for what you need. So if something should happen, you can treat that bird immediately. So firststatevetsupply.com. And, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope you have a wonderful weekend next weekend, long weekend with your family, and also a very safe trip to the poultry show you'll be attending the following weekend. And we'll touch base on when we can get you back on here.
Okay. Same to you, Andy, and I appreciate being on today.
Hey, thank you so much for coming on. We do appreciate you coming on. It was a great show. And answering all of your questions, folks, and we do that here. Backyard, you know, don't rely on the blogger forum. You're going to get burned. Guarantee it. We've seen it. I have specifically asked a poultry, certified poultry veterinarian, I've specifically asked him this question. How many dead birds do you see because people say they relied on information from a blog or forum? Her answer was thousands. Okay? How many dead chickens have you heard about, seen about, dealt with because the owner relied on a blog or forum? The answer, thousands. That's all, you know, we're not here about talking about curtains on nest boxes. We're not here talking about nice little flowers or posters or chandeliers in the coop. Or we're not talking about, you know, all these little treats that you're going to give your chickens or painting your chickens' nails. We specialize here bringing the experts on to give you the right information the first time to save your flock. Okay? A pretty coop's great. Okay? Get that information elsewhere. There's a lot of blogs out there and forums and Facebook pages about pretty coops and flowers and oatmeal and raisins and blueberries for your chickens in the morning. That's great. Go for it. But you're not going to get that here. You're going to get good, reliable, factual information from our panel of experts that we welcome on so you can get that information the first time correctly. Okay? That's what we're all about. So thank you so much for tuning in today. We hope you have a wonderful and blessed weekend with your family and friends. And like I said, we're for the most part here every day, Monday through Thursday, okay, Monday through Thursday, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. 60% chickens, 40% sustainable living. So we hope you can tune in whenever you can. And, again, appreciate all the folks in the chat room today. Hope you enjoyed the show. And we will see you next time on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer here on Blog Talk Radio. God bless everybody. Thank you.